All right, Fritzberger and Blood and Faith. It is the 20th of November, 2020. This is a little snapshot on evolution. I'm going to talk about how evolution has run its course, how atheism has run its course, how the existence myth of evolution is internally inconsistent and falling apart, how the entire Enlightenment is internally consistent and falling apart. So in order to change this world, we have to reestablish the foundation. If you assume that we're an accident, where does that lead you? If you assume that we our very existence is a complete and utter accident, if that is true, then the young men that went into the high school in Columbine in Aurora, Colorado, and shot their friends and then shot each other, in their world, in their little world, that becomes perfectly logical and perfectly acceptable. And that's the problem with this worldview that we've been teaching to our young people for generations and generations. Evolution has some fundamental problems. It assumes that entropy works in reverse. The problem is, how do you increase complexity? The myth suggests that in the beginning there was nothing, and there was no such thing as before nothing or before the beginning, but there was this big explosion. And this, I mean, you know, this big explosion, and from this explosion, the universe emerged. And they talk about inflation, the period of time in which matter moves faster than the speed of light. And then over time, however long you want to take it, billions of years, 14 billion years, you have whatever was there in the beginning, it began to coalesce and form matter. I'm talking, you know, atoms. So hydrogen atoms, helium atoms, carbon atoms, oxygen atoms, nitrogen atoms. And somehow this happened. Somehow you got the complexity of an atom. Protons, electrons, neutrons, the nuclear bonding that goes into making those things up. Nobody knows how that happened. And when you dig down into it, the reasoning tends to be a little bit circular, tends to be a little bit, well, it's there, therefore it had to be there, because if it wasn't there, we couldn't be here. And it's not a very satisfying, it's not intellectually very satisfying. There's no means to increase that complexity. And then somehow all those atoms got together and they woke up one day and they became a strand of DNA. And somehow that strand of DNA one day woke up and it was a single cell organism, and so on and so forth. And the problem is there's no way to increase complexity over time without design and work. And I was reading some evolutionary literature this morning. A guy wrote a book on evidence for evolution. And, you know, he talks a lot about natural selection. But what he does not talk about is the inability of natural selection to increase complexity. It reduces complexity. So if you have, for example, you've heard the story of the giraffe. Well, it used to be the giraffe had a little short leg, a little short neck, and he wanted to reach the leaves higher and higher in the tree, so his neck grew. Well, how does that happen? How does that happen? How does his neck grow? Well, he needed to get the leaves. Well, that's not an explanation of how the neck grew. At best, and this is out of one of my kids' natural selection studies from his high school, and it talks about the brown bunnies and the white bunnies. And in the wintertime, the white bunnies don't get eaten. The white bunnies live because they're camouflaged. And so over time, over 100 years or 500 years or 50 generations, you would expect to see more white bunnies in the population and less brown bunnies, because the brown bunnies get eaten by the coyotes. But that's not an increase in complexity. That's, if anything, it's a reduction in the types of population that already existed. That's, you had a genetic type, this bunny, who had different variable attributes that they could be born with brown fur or white fur, or brown fur and then the fur turns white in the winter. And it turns out after 50 generations or 500 generations, there's actually more bunnies that turn white or that are white during a winter climate than brown bunnies. But that's not an increase in complexity. That's simply saying, look, more of these folks are going to survive. That doesn't increase complexity. And that's the same way with a giraffe with a neck. Just because you have giraffes with long necks doesn't mean that that genetic potential wasn't there when they were created by God in the first place. The problem with evolution is it relies on the theory of reverse entropy, which is the second law of thermodynamics, which argues that if you leave something alone over time, it falls apart. You put a chunk of wood outside, leave it there for 1,000 years, you won't find it anymore. It falls apart. It doesn't come alive and grow, and it doesn't turn into a 747 or a spaceship or a human being or anything else. If anything, over time, things fall apart and they collapse. And, of course, that corresponds exactly what we see with in Genesis. When God created the world perfect and good, and then death and sin enter in, corruption enters in, and things get worse. The other thing that evolution presumes, with no proof, is that life comes from non-life. How does life, what's the origin of life? They don't know. The best they can come up with is, well, there was a green mud puddle, or there was a mud puddle, and lightning struck it, and, life emerged. And so all I can say is, are you trying to tell me that lightning struck a pool of water with inorganic life in it, and it oozed a strain of DNA? And this is what they would have you believe. And that's a long way of saying that at a certain time, and I think the time is now, I think we're in that age, the 21st century, when that genre, that existence myth, will have run its course. There's a book written by a guy named Thomas Kuhn. It's called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And what he did is he looked at all the great scientific revolutions over, a couple thousand years. And what he discovered was that when there's a change in, when there's a real scientific revolution, it is at first very, very resisted. People just like, nope, that's not true. It can't be true. If that was true, then everything we believe in is wrong. And a good example of that is whether or not the Earth revolves around the sun or the sun revolves around the Earth. And there was resistance for a long, long time saying, no, absolutely not. The sun revolves around the Earth. We have proof of that. That's the way it is. And you're off your rocker. And then when that change happened, it was sudden. And then people woke up and they said, well, of course that's the way it is. Of course the Earth revolves around the sun. And people forgot what they believed the year before, and everything is anew. And I think this evolutionary theory is certainly the same way. I think they're coming to the very end of it. You're actually seeing secular scientific journals that are coming out, and they're actually willing to start publishing things that fundamentally undermine the existence myth of evolution. That's pretty phenomenal. That's pretty amazing. It shows me that there's enough people out there that have fundamental questions about this existence myth. And I think that it probably in 100 years from now, people will say, why did we ever believe that? Why did anybody ever believe in evolution? Now, I'm not saying that in 100 years from now, everybody's going to believe in the creation account in Genesis. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm absolutely saying I think they're going to look back and they say, why did we ever believe that entropy works in reverse? Why did we ever believe that life comes from non-life? And sometimes the leading indicators of that aren't just the so-called scientist. Scientist is just a guy that's learned a lot. He's studied a lot. He knows a lot of things. And the problem with scientists or anybody else is they often all of us start from presuppositions of faith, whether they're conscious or not. But they start from a presupposition. If you start from a presupposition that God does not exist, well, everything forward from that is based upon that one assumption of faith that cannot be proven. But we also have other leading indicators of the failure of the existence myth of evolution. And what do I mean by that? Let's look at the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, long time ago. I want to say the 1970s. That's half a century ago. That's a long time ago. And if you've never seen the movie, it's a great movie. The soundtrack is spectacular. You today, 50 years, half a century later, you all recognize the soundtrack from the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, even if you've never seen the movie. It's that predominant still in our culture today. And in it, in the opening scenes, you got the monkey-like creature running around on a barren, rocky, desert-like surface of a planet. And he wakes up, and all of a sudden he sees this black obelisk. And it's making music or something like that. And he goes out and he touches this thing, and the next scene is there's the spaceman. The guy's flying around in a astronaut suit in a space shuttle or something like that, flying around in outer space. The story there being, it wasn't, nobody emerged spontaneously out of slime mold on Earth. This was a gift from the gods. There was this obelisk that was planted there that caused this monkey to explode in brain size. Now, obviously I don't want to get too theoretical on the movie itself. I mean, where did the monkey come in the first place? But the bottom line is there was an external factor that caused this monkey to become the spaceman over millions of years or whatever. And it's not just that. I like reading sci-fi. I read military sci-fi. Some of it is kind of lowbrow. It's not high-end literature, but I enjoy it. And one of my favorite authors, he talks about, and these aren't Christian authors, by the way, and he talks about the Noahs. It was just, of course there was Noahs. Noahs were people that came and seeded life to other planets throughout the galaxy or throughout the universe. And as these explorers are going along, they're trying to find the old relics. They're trying to find the old relics of these old ancient civilizations that had advanced technology beyond what they could even comprehend. They didn't even know how to make it work. And the presumption was, the Noahs put them there. These advanced previous races put them there. And, for sci-fi literature, that's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool answer. And part of that is there's, I think, a deep dissatisfaction inside the spirit of man, the soul of man, to suggest that we're just a freaking accident. And that certainly is reflective of that. And also, you see other movies, E.T. Phone Home, there's a cute little extraterrestrial out there. We yearn for the idea that there's something or somebody else out there, that we're not alone. You've got an explosion of literature on UFOs, lots of literature on the spaceman coming down. You've got the petroglyphs. You've got all these ancient writings. And they say, well, those are spacemen coming down. We were visited by aliens, and that's where we came from, and that's how they got this modern technology. And then you go into the studies of the ancient civilizations. People today, move this mic up just a little bit here. People today, that's hot mic. They don't know how they built the pyramids. They can't figure out how they moved those giant blocks. They don't know. They can't figure that out. If you go down to the Incas in South America, they can't figure out how the Incans made these rocks that weighed so much. They're bigger than men can carry. They're bigger than the llamas can carry. They're cut with such precision. And there's a lot of people, there's a lot of mysteries out there. People don't understand. It doesn't fit within this theory that we simply evolved out of nothing. And then there's a whole section of literature on why are these pictures of guys in spaceships? Here's a little saucer, a UFO saucer, written by these people from thousands of years ago. Where does that come from? And I sense that today's last couple centuries, but especially today, there's an arrogance on the part of our intellectual community that is unhealthy, and I think it's a sign of the impending collapse of their worldview. But there's an arrogance that suggests that we are the pinnacle of human existence and that we have figured out all the things that are fundamentally true, and that every culture that has gone before us were just ignorant rubes. And I find that completely ahistorical. My training is as a historian, PhD in history. Doesn't mean I know everything about history, but I tend to look at people and cultures in the millions of people and over centuries of time. And I would be very happy to say that the ancient cultures were every bit as smart as we are. I realize they didn't have electronic microphones and Apple computers, but they were every bit as smart as we are. And they had science, and they had languages, and they had amazing architecture. They did some great things. We just don't understand them. And that's not a dig on them. That's a dig on us. And I think the culture that we have created is a mile wide, and it's an inch deep. And this, I think, is also scaring a lot of people that have bought into that culture. And I think we're seeing signs of the collapse. This isn't just about who won the election or didn't win the election in the last 20 days. I think it's about something that's going on around the world. I think we're at the very end of the Enlightenment era, the sort of the French atheism that took over the world. Everybody's an atheist. If you grew up in this society, you're an atheist. You're trained to be an atheist. From kindergarten through graduate school, you're trained to be an atheist. You may go to church on Sunday. You may wear a cross around your neck. Madonna used to wear a cross around her neck until she started wearing that Jewish star. But your religion has been reduced to the flavor of ice cream that you prefer. And unfortunately, most Christians are okay with that. I'm a Christian. I go to church. I go to a singing club, and I hear the preacher talk. Would you come to church with me? And that's the beginning and the end of the Christian culture that they're in. And then they raise kids. They raise a family. And little Johnny goes off, and next thing you know, he shows up with lifestyle issues, shall we say. And mommy and daddy can't understand why he rejected their Christianity. And the answer is simple. What does it come down to? Is it the flavor of your ice cream, mom and dad? Because if that's the flavor of your ice cream, I got a different flavor of ice cream. And that kind of Christianity is not sustainable. I don't say that as an opinion. I just say it as somebody observing the world that we live in. It's not sustainable. Where is the Christian influence in anywhere in the world today? It's not. It's like, well, we have a vanilla ice cream. You like vanilla? Try some of ours. You don't like vanilla? That's fine. There's chocolate and strawberry too. It doesn't matter. And even the church believes it doesn't matter. And on the other hand, there's folks like me who start from assumption like if something's true, something's true. And if it's not true, it's not true. Disregard it. Cast it out. Cast it out and get rid of it and move on. Find out what's true. And that, of course, that requires a faith in truth in itself. But the truth is that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That is the truth. Now, I wasn't there in the beginning. So, yes, this is an acknowledgement that this is an act of faith. But I would also say that my conscious accepting of faith is at least it's internally consistent. What the evolutionists believe is that there is no such thing as faith, that faith is not legitimate, that everything is based on science. But we've already seen, and you don't need to take my word for it, we will see this played out in my lifetime, my children's lifetime, and their children's lifetime. It's falling apart. The worldview of atheism is internally inconsistent. The worldview, the existence myth of evolution is internally inconsistent, and it's falling apart. It's come full circle, and we certainly see this on the social sciences, where literature is no longer considered to be a perfect one-to-one correlation for what is. Rather, social scientists, historians write in order to create. They write in order to create. And the purpose of creation is to form a truth paradigm, which is a power paradigm, which controls people. Rebellion. It is a way of putting up the middle finger to a system that is on its last legs. It is ready to collapse. It is collapsing. It's not apparent to everybody yet. There's still a lot of true believers. But that is collapsing. And you can hasten that collapse just by putting up the middle finger. I've got a couple of podcasts that I enjoy listening to. One is The Z-Man. You can Google him up. He's from New Jersey. And he talks a lot about race realism, race reality. But he is one of the smartest guys I listen to. Keen intellect. And he was talking this morning about how people are willing to make fun of the rules, the accepted rules. And he was saying that that's actually a really healthy thing. Right now, everybody's freaked out about this COVID thing. And you've got the Karens out there screaming, wear your mask. You got to wear a mask. If you don't wear a mask, you're evil. And he says you can do little acts of defiance just to send these people over the edge. And that was where he was coming from. All right, Fritz Berggren, bloodandfaith.com, 20 November 2020. We will see you guys soon. Out.